this Sunday marks the 83rd Annual Academy Awards, and we've noticed that nearly all of the nominees for Best Picture have one thing in common. I'm talking about the credits. Usually at the beginning of the movie, when you see the names of the producers and companies that got the movie made, they flash on screen, one after another, after another, after another. NPR's Corey Turner tried to find out why there are so many producers these days.
This year's 10 Best Picture nominees have 110 producers among them. Co-producers, line producers, associate producers, executive and co-executive producers. Trying to decipher who actually made these movies left me feeling like Laurence Olivier on the hunt for the real Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus!
110 producers seemed like a lot, but what do I know? So I called up one of the masters.
Wow.
That's Larry Turman. He produced a little picture called The Graduate. 110 seemed like a lot to him, too, and way too many for me to explain. So I'm going to focus on one movie. The King's Speech began as a stage play. The writer's agent, Joan Lane, gave it to a pair of enterprising young movie producers, Simon Egan and Gareth Unwin, our first two producers. They optioned David Seidler's stage play and paid him to turn it into a screenplay. The pair had little going for them except for a good story and one very good actor, Jeffrey Rush, who'd also gotten the play from Seidler's agent. Here's Gareth Unwin.
Basically, she posted the stage play through his front door, and he came down to breakfast one morning, and there was this little orphan script sort of sat on the doormat.
Rush not only read it, he liked it and let the producers put his name on it. And for that, he's not only in the credits as an actor, but executive producer. Screenplay in hand, Unwin needed help raising the film's $15 million budget. So he brought in Ian Canning and Emile Sherman. It's these three lead producers you'll see take the stage Sunday if The King's Speech wins Best Picture. There was just one very big problem, says Canning.
We were financing the film with the backdrop of the financial crisis. It was a time when any film which, whatever the prefix, if it had drama in it, was seen as being very hard from an audience commercial perspective.
But with Jeffrey Rush involved, the project did attract some backers, including Mark Foligno and partner Deepak Sika. They put in a small piece of the budget, and in return, they got executive and co-executive producer credits. For those of you counting at home, that makes seven. To sift through the financing offers, the producers of The King's Speech hired Libby Saville. What does she do?
Well, I'm a partner in a law firm.
A lawyer, for people trying to make movies. Among the project's suitors was the Weinstein Company. In the 1990s, Harvey and Bob Weinstein all but cornered the market on small, award-winning movies. But a few years ago, they lost their way in a wilderness of bad choices and bad movies. The King's Speech must have seemed, to Harvey Weinstein and his team, like a chance to return to form. Libby Saville.
They kind of jumped on the aeroplane and came over here and parked themselves at my offices, I know them incredibly well, so I know the modus operandi, but it's incredibly effective, actually.
Two more executive producers, Harvey and Bob Weinstein. Plus, for her trouble, Libby Saville got a co-executive producer credit. Now, if you're thinking, after 10 producers and a big money commitment from the Weinsteins, that The King's Speech was a go, you're wrong. Ultimately, they needed five more producers to make their movie. And that brings our grand total to 15.
From the financial side, the fact that these people have chosen to take credits, I wish that they wouldn't.
That's Mark Gordon, producer of Saving Private Ryan and co-president of the Producers Guild. The fact is, there haven't always been this many producers' names in the credits. Just ask Larry Turman how many people produced The Graduate.
Me alone.
Turman optioned the novel with his own money and then raised outside financing when the Hollywood studios all said no.
There's been a slow but inexorable devaluation of producing.
Mark Gordon agrees. He was one of eight producers on Saving Private Ryan, but he made a far smaller film released just last year called The Messenger, and it needed 13 producers.
Because that movie was cobbled together financially, that was the price that had to be paid in order to get the movie made.
In other words, it's often true that the bigger the movie, the fewer the producers. That's why Toy Story 3 has 3 producers, and The Kids Are All Right needed 20. The allure of getting your name on a movie has become a kind of bait to lure investors to movies that big studios just won't touch. To be fair to producers who do more than write a check, Gordon and the Producers Guild are working on a system that would make it clearer, in the credits, to audiences, who did the heavy lifting. In the meantime, we're left with 10 very good movies up for Best Picture, 110 producers, and one nagging question. Does it matter how many people take credit for a good movie, as long as the movie gets made? Again, Gareth Unwin.
You know, it's about getting that film into production, getting it made, and getting it as good as you possibly can. And, you know, whether that's from the toil of one person or 50, then, you know, we're a results-based industry, as they say.
An industry that will always find a way to leave us speechless. Corey Turner, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Remember cassettes? They gave a lot of people their first chance to carry around and record music, or anything else for that matter. From mixtapes to kids' violin lessons to early hip-hop releases, cassettes were a cheap way to capture and circulate sonic expression. Well, here's some good news for those of you waxing nostalgic right now. Cassettes have not gone away. For the latest in our series on formats, NPR's Neda Ulaby explores today's cassette tape culture.
An out-of-business East Los Angeles bar. There's a clubhouse for lovers of experimental media and music.
There we go. That's a tape sound.
It's called Dub Lab. It's an artistic collective. Today, their project is an internet broadcast of DJs playing cassettes.
This is Top Tape, a special magnetic music broadcast for your ears. Matthew David is first up on deck.
When he's not DJing, Matthew David runs a micro-label. It's called Leaving Records, part of a small but enthusiastic community of people releasing new music on cassette.
This is actually something I recorded yesterday in Topanga Canyon with a friend to tape.
To tape, but why?
It's the most accessible, easiest, cheapest way for anyone to record a piece of audio.
Okay, it's democratic, and it's do-it-yourself. Anyone can do it, including a pair of 22-year-olds who founded their own tiny tape label a year ago. It's called Kill Hurt. Its roster is 5 bands. That includes Cowabunga Babes from Austin, Texas.
A lot of our friends, when we first started this, and our family too, laughed at us. They thought it was the most hilarious thing. They said cassettes.
But Katrina Boza and her boyfriend, Chris Johnley, say cassettes are the perfect format for the music they like.
Cassettes and punk music and noise music and underground music, they've always had this kind of symbiotic relationship.
Cassette tape is trebly. It favors certain frequencies. But that makes it ideal for certain genres. Garage rock, freak folk, anything that doesn't depend on high fidelity, where tape's inherent trashiness becomes an intentional effect.
Vinyl is really nice and crisp and warm, and digital files are, you know, very clean.
Tape label boss, Katrina Boza.
Cassette, the quality of it degrades over time. It's staticky, it's noisy, but a lot of the bands we're putting out and a lot of bands that are becoming more and more popular in the independent world nowadays are noisy and scratchy.
That's one of Kilhurt's other bands, Pizza. Cassette's hiss and distortion serves its natural nastiness in a good way. Cassettes now are a gatekeeper in the way some labels used to be, for people who like this kind of music and are overwhelmed wading through the options online.
Mainstream act after mainstream act, you got indie act after indie act, bigger indie labels, blog, bands.
Chris Johnley works in web development, so he's online all day, every day.
After a while, you're kind of just like, this stinks, you know.
His cassette label brings him out of the virtual world and into clubs to scope out bands. And it compels him to handle actual things, flipping, inserting, rewinding. John Lee's Los Feliz apartment is dominated by technology nearly as old as he is.
These machines are like, they're like printer-sized, big, gray doorstops.
Where did you find them?
On eBay.
eBay. We got a ridiculously good deal.
Yeah, I mean, 20 years ago, it's like $3,500 worth of equipment.
As opposed to the $200 they spent buying their duplicators and decks. Gilhurd sold about 250 cassettes so far and cleared a couple $100.
It's chump change, but, yeah, you know, we're going to break even.
Gilhurd sells cassettes with its website, at shows, and through little indie boutiques, including Ooga Booga in L.A.'s Chinatown. It's frequented by August Brown, who covers music for the L.A. Times. He says this city is uniquely suited for a new generation of cassette fans to flourish. After all, he says, if you live in L.A. and you're into cassettes...
You probably also have some terrible 1989 Honda Accord with, you know, non-functioning windows that, you know, happens to have a tape deck.
There's something about L.A.'s car culture that lends itself to cassette culture, particularly for artfully scruffy connoisseurs of cool, Brown says.
There's a certain Los Angeles zen to putting on some massive sun-warped, decayed thing while going to the beach.
The idea that format says something about community has larger implications, says Mark McNeil of Dublab. His creative crew brings together all aspects of cassette culture, recording new music, finding old music, and creating new sounds from old stuff you find.
Oh, man, I got a million dreams.
You have this potential of finding some of the most wild, one-of-a-kind tapes out there. You're finding home recordings of people, demos, amazing, weird hypnosis tapes, people recording lectures, mixtapes.
Mixtapes. Cassette culture refuses to lose what mixtapes represent. A handmade, personalized aesthetic. A talismanic artifact. For the few people still stubbornly making them, cassettes remain a meaningful way to preserve art. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
In the old days, movies, even the big epics, were shot on studio back lots. Tara, that iconic plantation in Gone with the Wind, was made of plywood and paper mache. These days, movie locations are mostly real, and they're found by location scouts, who are often the first people hired for a movie. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg met with some for her annual pre-Oscar series on movie jobs.
Location scout. Easy. He, usually their men, drives around town, spots a house, thinks it could work for the film, and drives home. Well, no. They're filming a car chase in downtown Los Angeles. It's just one location John Panzarella found for the Justin Timberlake movie, Now.
In many scripts, you get about 40 locations. In this picture, there are 100 different locations.
And John Panzarella had to find them all. Bridges, tunnels, office buildings, apartments, beaches. Then, once the shooting starts, he has to manage every location.
Setting up parking, making arrangements with all the neighbors, making the deals with the places that we're going to be filming, and sort of babysitting the whole crew to make sure that everybody plays nice together.
Location managers have to handle the enmity of non-movie makers. Two bridges have been closed for today's shoot. You can imagine how happy that makes L.A. drivers. Near Hollywood, some streets are closed for the Matt Damon movie We Bought a Zoo. Director Cameron Crowe is filming in the neighborhood of Los Feliz, where Carrie Sutkin lives. So to me, it looks very exciting. Got a movie shooting down your street.
But the street's been closed for 2 days. But it's kind of fun. Yesterday, I came in angry, and then Matt Damon kept walking by, and then I was happy by the end of the shoot.
And what about four-legged neighbors? Miles away, on a 450-acre ranch, location manager Chris Baugh is overseeing the creation of the film's zoo.
Tigers are going to be just on the other side of these trees right here. And if you can see next door, there's some horses from the ranch next door.
Very calm right now.
Well, wait till we bring in the big cats.
Plus, there will be lots of other creatures on the film.
Flamingos, llamas, monkeys, and the bear.
For a six-week shoot, Chris Ba will also have to provide facilities for the care, feeding, and safety of a tamer group, one hopes, the cast and crew. What point would you simply say, this is just too hard, we've got to build it in a soundstage?
We're not allowed to say no. We have to make it work. So we find a way.
Location scout Lori Balton found this ranch. She discovered it first for the film Seabiscuit. Lori says a big part of scouting is getting inside the director's head to find sites that match his or her mental images. Working with director Michael Bay on Pearl Harbor was a challenge.
He said, I want something white. It's got to be white. It's got to be white. It's got to be white. Oh, week after week into months, we're looking for white, white, white. And finally, I see something black. And I go, you know what? This kind of works. I'm going to show it to him. And he looks at it, and he looks at me, and he goes, this is exactly what I asked you to find. Why did it take so friggin' long?
Scouting can mean days and weeks in the car, a kind of home away from home.
Let's see. I have a toolkit. Safety goggles. You never know when a windstorm's going to come up. I have an extra pair of socks.
The most important item in location scout location manager Doug Dresser's trunk is a camera. Today he is checking out six L.A. sites and will take loads of photos to show the director and production designer.
Big open space. You could build sets in here. We'd pull our movie trucks right up here.
But the smell... It's a defunct dairy near L.A.'s Chinatown, huge warehouse with the distinct aroma of sour milk. Not right for his film, a fantasy adventure, teenagers, abandoned buildings, creepy, like the next location Doug scouts.
So we're inside the morgue of the former Linda Vista Hospital. It's a cold and dark basement, paint peeling off of the walls.
You hang out in an awful lot of really dreadful places, Doug.
It's a glamorous profession.
There is some glamour at a small corner restaurant in Los Feliz today. They're shooting the Matt Damon movie, We Bought a Zoo.
Matt should be stepping out any minute. All right.
Location manager Chris Ba has left the zoo construction on the ranch and is here solving problems. This one from the shows they call movies shows in movie land, the show's best boy Grip.
Hi.
Can I put my carts tonight up on that sidewalk?
Yeah, no, that shouldn't be a problem. Okay. Thanks for asking.
Chris says location managing is like throwing a full-blown wedding for 200 people in a different place every day for 50 days. Some days, commandos drop on the roof or a machine gun fight begins, and then there's a tidal wave. Fun.
And that's a cut. That's a cut. Okay, very nice.
Inside the restaurant, between takes, director Cameron Crowe says it's all worth it if it helps actors like Damon.
What was great was to be able to bring him to these places and say, this is what we found. And he immediately said, I feel the movie here. I can play this character.
For Cameron Crowe, the long, hard work of location scouting and then set designing, lighting, cinematography, performing, directing, all of it is best when it disappears.
The movie should make it all feel invisible. The movie should feel like you're just viewing somebody living a life. To be living a life on screen, they have to feel like that's their house. This is where they were born. Or they're comfortable enough to make you believe it.
And so, location, location, location. The first step in getting us to suspend disbelief for a few hours and enter other lives.
Is this heaven?
It's Iowa.
In California, I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
You, too, can scout some movie locations just by going to our website, npr.org. And from NPR News, this is Morning Edition, edited by Greg Myrie and Chuck Holmes. The editorial staff includes Mike Kennedy, Rena Advani, Shanita Anderson, Kitty Isley, Ann Hawk, Jordana Hochman, Miranda Kennedy, Laura Krantz, and Maeve McGoran, with Shannon Rhodes and Nina Gregory here at NPR West. Our executive producer is Madalika Sicca. The executive director of news programming is Ellen McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Renee Montaigne.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The Academy Awards are this weekend, but we're going to look back now to 1957. One of the Oscar nominees for Best Documentary that year was Lionel Rogerson's On the Bowery. It was set on New York City's Skid Row. In addition to an Oscar nomination, the film won the top documentary prize at the Venice Film Festival. But Rogerson then fell largely into the footnotes of American cinematic history. Now, Rick Carr reports, that's changing.
Imagine this happening today. The director of an indie film about alcoholics on the streets of Lower Manhattan lands an interview on the Today Show. It happened to Lionel Rogerson, who was grilled by host Dave Garraway.
Mr. Rogerson, what made you want to make a movie that must leave people, most people anyhow, depressed when they leave the theater?
Well, Dave, I don't think it's a film that leaves people depressed. Have you seen the film?
No.
On the Bowery is a stylized snapshot of life in New York's gin mills and flop houses. Its main character is a guy named Ray Salyer, who Rogerson found living on the Bowery. In the film, he's new in town. He shows up in a Skid Row bar and buys a bottle of cheap wine for some guys he meets there. When the bottle's empty and there's no more forthcoming, all of his new friends take off but one, the film's other main character, Gorman Hendricks.
I've seen him more in evidence, so naturally he's gonna go.
Anything for a drink, huh?
Yeah, I reckon.
Yeah, well, that's the way it goes.
Well, the Bowery boy.
Hendricks and Salyer will do just about anything for a drink, too. They end up selling off some clothes in Salyer's bag. Then they get loaded. The next day, they scrounge for work or panhandle in Midtown. Then they get loaded. And so on. Throughout the film, the men portray themselves. Director Rogerson sketched out scenes, then let the men basically play out their own lives for the camera. Between those sequences, Rogerson cut in shots of real life along Skid Row. Men pick rags, pass bottles, and pass out on sidewalks. But there's a lot more going on in this depiction of the Bowery's alcoholics.
You go beyond seeing their problems and their difficulties to their seeing their humanity. I think that's one of the most important things about the film.
That's Michael Rogerson, the director's son. Lionel Rogerson died 10 years ago. Michael's been leading the drive to revive his father's work. He's made his own career as a painter, and he says the images in his father's films, especially the detailed black and white portraits in On the Bowery, floor him.
Yeah, the human face is something rather extraordinary. I think my father had an extraordinary fascination and feeling for it, which comes through in that film. Every time I see it, I see something I haven't seen before. I think it's a phenomenon which I find actually rather incredible, because you see a film 5, 10 times, and you see something new each time, and I never get tired of it. I think it has to do with the beauty of the cinematography, but also this whole concept of portraiture of these faces, which are ravaged but very human and beautiful at the same time.
Those portraits of the Bowery men were actually inspired by Rembrandt. But Lionel Rogerson didn't just set out to make a beautiful film. In a documentary about On the Bowery, he said he wanted to change the world, so he abandoned the family business.
One day I said, well, I'm going to get out of this textile business, synthetic fiber business. I'm going to make films about what's going on in the world. We just came through the Holocaust, which was insane. Something's wrong. I have to find out with my camera.
His son, Michael Rogerson, says the U.S. wasn't really ready to see what was wrong with society. Sure, the film won an Oscar nomination, raves from critics, and the top documentary prize in Venice. But after that awards ceremony, Michael Rogerson says his father learned just how the U.S. establishment saw the film.
So there was some kind of a big to-do afterwards. You know, a lot of Italian press. The American ambassador was there, and I think my father went to shake her hand or whatever, and she turned her back on him and walked out.
We're talking about the period when McCarthy was still, if he was not there in person, then his spirit was still there.
That's Jonas Mekas, one of Lionel Rogerson's peers on New York's avant-garde film scene in the 50s, not long after Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy's communist witch hunts. Mekas is also founder of the city's anthology film archives, which preserved the negative of On the Bowery. He says Lionel Rogerson was a member of a seminal group of New York filmmakers.
They had possibilities and dreams but nobody wanted to sponsor their films. I mean, Lionel kept writing scripts and nobody wanted to produce his films.
Lionel Rogerson's second film won raves from critics, too. 1959's Come Back Africa is another docudrama set in the townships of South Africa under apartheid. It'll be released to theaters and on DVD, along with On the Bowery, later this year. While the movies live on the Bowery's two main characters didn't do so well. Shortly after the film was completed, Gorman Hendricks drank himself to death. And Ray Salyer, whose good looks and charisma won him an invitation to Hollywood, simply disappeared. For NPR News, I'm Rick Carr in New York.